From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Over the last few weeks, we've learned about how Chris Bynum found himself in a Gary Police Department interrogation room and ultimately confessed to being involved in the murders of Liz, Sheila, Anthony, Suzanne, and Angela. From his perspective, we had heard that his name was being thrown around as being involved. We never actually hear anything about an alleged anonymous tip in any of the reports or interviews. Chris then, because he and everyone else from the Aetna neighborhood knew how the Gary PD operates, tried to stay hidden from the police. This lasted for about 24 hours until his girlfriend Shanita was picked up by officers and called Chris to help the police find him. Once he was located at around noon on Friday the 18th of February, he was taken to the station and placed in an interrogation room by Detective Lewis Donald. Over the course of about 8 hours, Chris was denied anything to eat, drink, or even a bathroom break. Donald continually pushed him to make a statement about the murders while Chris refused and kept asking for a lawyer. Donald not only refused him his right to an attorney, but also threatened him, both physically as well as threats made to incarcerate Shanita, which Donald claimed would land Chris's small child in Child Protective Services. At around 9 p.m. that night, Chris was taken out into the bullpen of the station so that he could see that Donald wasn't bluffing. Chris saw Shanita on the other side of the station, sitting in a chair with her face in her hands. At that point, he relented and agreed to sign off on his Miranda rights and make the statement that Donald had fed to him. That's when Detectives Galt and Moxley were brought in to witness and type up the statement. It took over 2 hours to get it right, but eventually Donald got what he wanted. A statement that puts Chris on the scene and pointing the finger at Shaky McIntosh and Terrell Jackson. Terrell was arrested that very same evening but never gave a statement. The next morning, Shaky came in. He gave a statement where he claimed no involvement at all in the murders, but he put a gun in Chris's hand that night and told Donald that Chris and Amp had had an argument. Shaky was then shown a copy of Chris's statement implicating him and sent out to the yard to confront Chris. There, he threatened Chris's family if he didn't remove his name from the statement. That was on Saturday. On Sunday, Chris found himself back in the interrogation room again, where he completely changed his story. In this new version, the version the jury heard, Chris claimed that it was actually Amp who killed Liz and Sheila, and then Chris killed the other three victims in self-defense. Shaky and Terrell were completely removed from the narrative. Donald fed this story to Chris with the assurance that he wouldn't face much prison time because the story really implicated Amp and Chris's role was limited to an accident and defending himself from an imminent threat. Following the statement, Chris was told to take investigators along with the dive team to Lake Michigan to find the gun that he claimed to have thrown in the water. Donald knew this was a wild goose chase. His intention was just to go through the motions, looking for the gun that he told Chris to say that he had dumped in the water. But everyone quickly realized that there was no way the gun could be in the lake due to the ice shelf and the pure driven snow on the ground. Chris was taken back into custody, where he still remains today, 25 years later. That is the story according to Chris Bynum. But that's nowhere near the story that the jury heard at his trial. In today's episode, you're going to hear the other side of the story through the testimony of Detective Lewis Donald. Donald's testimony began like any other. We learned that at the time of the murders, he'd been with the Gary PD for about 8 years, since 1992. We didn't hear much about Donald at the beginning of our investigation because he wasn't the first at either scene. He became involved in the afternoon of the 17th at the ballpark. He was in the area when the bodies of Liz and Sheila were discovered, and he responded to assist Detective Galt. Where we did hear about him was a short quote that I read to you from this transcript. If you can remember back to the episode about the connections between the crime scenes, I pointed out that Detective Donald is the one who had insisted that the two scenes were connected almost immediately. From the transcript, quote, "After that, we proceeded back to the station, and I expressed my concern to Detective Galt in reference to these homicides and three other homicides earlier that morning. And I told him I believed that they were related, and I bet we're going to find a connection to the two." End quote. Donald was apparently right, at least according to the official narrative. And to be fair, my own analysis as well is that the two scenes are connected. But after returning to the station, Donald ended up playing a pivotal role in both cases, which had already become one case by then. This is when he was assigned to track down Chris Bynum. And in the transcript, we almost get an explanation as to how Chris's name actually came up, but an objection by Chris's attorney left that question unanswered. Quote, "At some point, did you become involved in an effort to locate Cleveland Christopher Bynum?" "Yes, I did." "And describe how that came about and what your role was in that." "Well, through Detective Galt and Detective Moxley's investigation, they had learned that it..." "Mr. Graddick, I'm going to object. That appears to be hearsay, Your Honor." The judge: response? Collins: "I'll rephrase the question. Had you gotten a name as a result of the steps that the investigation had gone through at that point?" Donald: "Yes." End quote. Donald goes on to explain that he was specifically looking for Chris Bynum and DeAndre McIntosh. Shaky. Interestingly, there's no mention of Terrell at this point, which is odd because years later, the official story is that there was an anonymous tip naming Chris, Shaky, and Terrell, and that's what set things into motion. But from what Donald said on the stand, he was only looking for Shaky and Chris. More on this in a few minutes. As his testimony continues, he walks through the process of finding and arresting Chris. And this part appears to be pretty consistent with what we've already learned. They located Chris's car driving down the road and pulled it over. Shanita was driving it at the time, and they had her call Chris to get her to tell him where he was. Officers then went to the house to pick him up, and he left out the side door before they could check inside. Chris was ultimately arrested at a neighbor's house. Again, this is the same story that we've already heard. But there are some differences in the story from here. Chris testified at his PCR hearing that he was made to walk around in the snow barefoot at the scene on 10th Avenue for a period of time before getting transported to the station. But according to Detective Donald, Chris was read his rights right there on the scene and then immediately transported to the station. That's just a slight variation from Chris's version, but the most important differences come once they get into that interrogation room, right after this break. Just like with all the other witnesses, Collins, the prosecutor, is careful not to ask certain questions of Donald. The types of questions that might raise even more questions from the jury. Her questioning of Donald skips a massive block of time in the day Chris was arrested. She had the detective go into great detail about the search for Chris, what happened when they located him, how he fled out the side door and jumped a fence, where he was cuffed. She even has him go into detail about where he got the Miranda card to read Chris's rights at the scene. From the transcript, quote, "You indicated that you placed him under arrest. Can you describe the arrest procedure? Specifically, did you have occasion to read him his rights at that early state?" "Yes, we did. He was placed in handcuffs directly in front of the house and read his rights right there in front of the house. Then he was placed into a detective car where he was then transported to the Gary City Jail. When you read him his rights, how do you do that? Describe that process that you follow." "I had got a card from a patrol unit because, of course, I'm a plainclothes officer and I had got a card from a patrolman and read the rights right off the card, the Miranda card." "And on this card, did you advise him he had a right to remain silent?" "Yes, I did." "And did you advise him he had a right to an attorney?" "Yes, I did." "Did you advise him that he could stop and request an attorney at any time if he wanted to, and that would be that?" "Yes, I did." "And did you advise him that he could refuse to answer any questions that were asked of him?" "Yes, I did." "And did you tell him that if he couldn't hire an attorney, one would be provided for him?" "Yes, I did." After advising him there on the street from the card, What did you do with him? Where'd you take him? He was immediately transported to the Gary City Jail at 1301 Broadway, where he was taken upstairs to the Detective Bureau to be processed. End quote. Notice that Collins is making sure that the jury is crystal clear about the fact that Chris knew his Miranda rights before giving his statement, which is where all this is leading. Then here comes the big jump in time. In the testimony, no times are given. We only hear words like, immediately, Bynum was immediately transported to the police station. Then right after that, we jump to this. Quote, did there come a time, Corporal, that you sat down with some other officers to talk to him and take a formal statement from him? End quote. So what the jury heard was that Chris tried to flee, he was apprehended, read his rights, taken to the station immediately, then he gave a statement. But before we get to the statement, we get several more pages of transcript describing the process of reading Chris's Miranda rights again and him initialing the pages of the warning and waiver form, and ultimately signing the form, waiving his right to an attorney and to remain silent. The jury at this point has absolutely no idea that Chris spent around 8 hours in that interrogation room with Donald alone before he finally agreed to sign the form. The testimony is meant to lead them to believe that he just signed off right after he got there. There's not one single question about how long he was in the station, what was happening during those 8 hours. Nothing. Just a long, drawn-out explanation about how the process went of Chris acknowledging his rights and voluntarily waving them away. And regarding the accusations Chris made at his PCR hearing, Donald has a very different version of how things went down. Remember, Chris claims he spent hours insisting that he wanted an attorney and refused to sign the waiver form despite being threatened repeatedly. But here's Donald's version. Quote, did you guys make any threats or promises when you were going through the waiver form with him? No. Did anybody threaten him or anything of that nature? No. As far as you could tell from your interactions with him, did he agree to talk to you in a voluntary manner? Yes. End quote. At this point, Chris's first statement was entered in as an exhibit, but it wasn't read to the jury. They did have access to it, a copy of it, but it wasn't read to them. And then Donald says that Shaky came into the station to give a statement the next day, and this is when all hell breaks loose. While the state had no intention of calling Shaky as a witness, his name was of course in that first statement from Chris. And Donald made him out to look like a Boy Scout in front of the jury. He said that the next day Shaky came into the station on his own accord because he had heard that the police were looking for him. Then he said that Shaky asked him if he could take a polygraph test. Chris's attorney, Graddick, stood up immediately and objected and requested that a mistrial be declared. This was followed by a long bench conference where Graddick tried to argue that the state was trying to make Shaky look completely credible in front of the jury by emphasizing that he had went voluntarily to the station and that he had requested to take the polygraph. And I think that he correctly argued that without Shaky being called as a witness and subject to cross-examination, the inference is crystal clear. Shaky is an outstanding citizen who just wanted to come in and tell the truth about Chris. Collins, on the other hand, insisted that she wasn't going to get into Shaky any more than just mentioning that he came in for questioning. And ultimately, the judge decided that as long as nothing more was said about Shaky, then the mistrial motion was denied and questioning resumed. And here's where things get a bit strange. So, remember in our last episode, I explained that Terrell was picked up for questioning during Chris's interrogation at about 9:30 p.m. on Friday night. In Donald's testimony, though, he never mentions Terrell by name, but he says they did pick up another suspect for questioning. Now, as far as I know, the only person he could be referring to is Terrell, and he actually explains that that's exactly who he was talking about in a bench conference later. But Donald's timing is all off. He claims on the stand that Chris gave his statement on Friday night. Then on Saturday, Shaky, the choir boy, came in and voluntarily asked to take a polygraph test. Then he says he and other detectives went back out to the crime scenes to make sure they hadn't missed anything and then picked up this other suspect for questioning. He doesn't say why the person was a suspect, if he gave a statement, if he was arrested or charged, nothing. Just that they picked him up. But he says they picked him up on Saturday after Shaky gave his statement and after a return trip to the crime scenes. Now, this may not seem important, But let me explain why all this matters. What we hear in the post-conviction proceedings is that Chris, Shaky, and Terrell all came onto the police radar because of an anonymous tip that named them as being involved. My guess, based on some information you're going to get later, is that if there was a tip, it likely named Chris, Shaky, and Terrell, but not Chris Bynum, just Chris. In any case, according to what we're told later in the process, someone named all three men as suspects. But the way the story is told to the jury, Chris is picked up, no reason is given why. Then he makes a statement that's presented as evidence that names Shaky and Terrell. Then, after the other two men are named, Shaky, the Good Samaritan, comes in and voluntarily makes a statement and asks for a polygraph and isn't charged. Then, again in this version, after Chris names him in his statement, another man, who the jury is left to infer as Terrell, is questioned. So put yourself into the position of the jurors here. What do you think is going on? To me, it seems pretty clear. It sounds like Chris was the only real suspect. He was brought in, and he gives a statement naming two other people. Those two people are questioned and then released. You're left believing that the only reason the other two men were ever suspects to begin with was because of Chris's statement, when the reality is that the police were looking for all three of them from the very beginning, as evident by the fact that Terrell was arrested before Chris named him in that first statement. And all of this is a perfect setup for what comes next, Chris's second statement. Now, in Chris's version, the second statement was provoked by Shaky being shown his first version and then released into the yard to confront and threaten him. But that's not how things went at all in Donald's version. In fact, Detective Donald can't even remember why they brought Chris back into the interrogation room on Sunday. Quote, "All right, what steps did you take in your investigation?" We brought Mr. Bynum back down." "Okay, what was your purpose for bringing Mr. Bynum back down?" "I believe, and I'm not positive on this, to say his 48 hours, I'm not sure. I know we had informed him that he had a warrant," end quote. At this point, things get a little wonky in the testimony. Donald starts to say that Chris was taken up to the station from the jail so that he could be informed that he had other warrants. Then he says he was interviewing another witness when Chris knocked on that door. This leads to another bench conference, and Graddick is pissed because Donald had been questioned on voir dire outside of the presence of the jury prior to this. The purpose in that was to make sure everyone knew what he was going to testify to and to set the ground rules regarding hearsay. Apparently, this Chris knocking on the door situation was new information. The jury was dismissed, and Graddick got to question Donald in another version of voir dire about what had happened. Here, he says that he was interviewing Angel Walker regarding the obstruction of justice charge that I mentioned a couple weeks ago when Chris knocked on the interrogation room door and told him that he felt bad for involving other people in his lies, and now he wanted to come clean and tell the truth. And it's during this questioning, that again was outside of the presence of the jury, that we get a little glimpse into Donald's real personality. He even speaks differently when the jury's not there. Check out this little exchange between him and Graddick. Quote, "And when he knocked on the door, did you tell him that Angel Walker was there?" "He knew that already." "Okay. Did you tell him that he had better sign a statement?"
"No."
"Because his girlfriend was there?"
"No."
"She was about to get in trouble?"
"No."
"You didn't tell him that?"
"No."
"At any time?"
"No."
"Why did you smile when I asked you that question?"
"Because I knew you was going to ask that."
"Why did you know that?
Because you told him that?"
"No, I knew that's what you was leading to, that's why."
End quote.
I can just imagine Donald's shitty smirk during that questioning. And I think it's worth noting that somehow he knew that Graddick was going to ask him about the threats regarding Shanita. It's interesting, isn't it? How would he know that question was coming if it didn't happen? It seems like a very specific thing to anticipate, doesn't it? And as it turns out, there was someone else who wasn't particularly impressed with Donald's testimony or his attitude. Shanita Walker.
After the bench conference, the judge ordered a short recess. During the recess, the judge ordered the lawyers and Detective Donald into chambers to talk about an incident that occurred after his little performance outside the presence of the jury. Shanita, apparently, had something to say to him. From the transcript, quote, the judge, we're on the record in chambers. Counsel for state and defense are present along with Officer Lewis Donald, Gary Police Department. It was brought to the court's attention during recess by one of the bailiffs that a communication was made to Officer Donald by an individual in the gallery. Officer Donald, would you state for the record as best you can describe that individual and state what they said to you? Donald, she's a light-complected female, black, approximately 5'9". She has black hair, black coat on, and was carrying a child. So as I was exiting the courtroom from recess, she said to me, why don't you go on outside and make up some more motherfucking lies? The judge, did you respond to her in any way? Donald, no, I immediately turned around and asked for Miss Collins, and she told me to tell the bailiff, and I did so. End quote. Once the jury came back in, things continued on just about how you'd expect them to. Chris had a Jay Wilds moment where he decided he wanted to come clean. He felt terrible for lying on Shaky and Terrell, and he gave his second statement, confessing to killing Amp, Angela, and Suzanne. And unlike the first statement, which was just entered in as an exhibit, this one, the confession, was read to the jury in its entirety. Hey everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads. I'm going to wrap things up today with Graddick's cross-examination. While I've been pretty critical of his performance in most of the testimonies we've covered so far, I will say that he was pretty hamstrung when it came to Donald. There was really only one thing that Graddick needed to do in cross, that he had to do in order for his cross to be effective. He had to find some way to invalidate the confession that the jury heard during direct. Unfortunately, there just really wasn't a good or even reasonable way to do that. The jury heard the confession. They saw with their own eyes that Chris had signed the Miranda waiver and initialed every page of the statement as well as signing it at the end. The only way Graddick could have brought any doubt into the jury's mind about the statement would have been to let them hear Chris's version of events. Make them understand that Chris signed the waiver and gave the statement under the veil of coercion and threats. Sadly, that was impossible. He knew damn well that if he asked those questions of Donald, he would just deny it. And putting Chris on the stand would have been a terrible idea. The risk to reward would be extremely lopsided. You risk Chris getting destroyed on cross-examination,
and the reward would be him making accusations that the jury likely wouldn't have believed anyway. So Graddick went into Cross without any feasible options to undo the damage of direct. He did try. He poked around at some inconsistencies in reports, but they weren't reports that Donald wrote himself, so he was able to easily dodge those questions. He asked about paraffin testing to see if Chris had fired a gun recently. That's the test you see on crime dramas on TV, where CSIs drip liquid on a person's hand. If it reacts a certain way, then, according to TV, you know that they had fired a gun. But Donald just played dumb and left Graddick with nothing. He claimed that not only did he not know if any gunshot residue tests were performed, but he says he wasn't even familiar with what the test was, never heard of it. Then Graddick tried to tie Shaky and Terrell back to Larry Brooks' statement about one of the killers having a gap in their teeth. He asked if Shaky had a chip or gap in his teeth, and Donald says he doesn't remember. He asked the same thing about Terrell, and Donald says he thinks he might have had a chip in his tooth, but he's not sure. And then this is where we get a little more explanation as to what happened with Terrell. Donald is asked if Terrell ever gave a statement or signed a Miranda form, and he says that he refused to do either one. He did not waive his rights and did not give a statement. Basically, he was brought in, refused to talk, and he was released. So then Graddick circles back to the physical descriptions, asking Donald if either Shaky or Terrell had a large nose. Because remember, in Larry's written statement, he said one of the guys had a big nose. But Donald continues to play dumb, so Graddick pivots. He starts asking Donald what reports he used in his investigation. What he was trying to do is to get Dame's report in, where Larry said that he didn't see anyone or recognize the voices. But Collins sniffs this out and objects immediately. There's a short conference at the bench where she says that anything brought in from Dame's statement about what Larry said would be hearsay. And the judge agrees and sustains the objection. In my opinion, there were really only two places where Graddick might have been able to accomplish what he was after in Cross, and he missed them both. The theme of his cross-examination was to try to distract from the confession and direct the jury's attention back towards Shaky and Terrell. Remember, he tried to get in Dame's report on Larry's statement that there were two men involved. He tried to get Donald to admit that between the two guys there was a gap tooth and a big nose, but he missed the one tangible thing that he could have used. The fact that Terrell was arrested before Chris named him in his statement. Like I explained earlier, if the goal was to throw shade at Terrell, that was really the only path to do so. To point out that Terrell was a real suspect before Chris ever mentioned his name. Unfortunately, Graddick didn't catch that discrepancy. In the other place where I think he could have done some damage but didn't was regarding the amount of time that Chris was in the police station. The process during direct sounded very smooth and easy. Chris is arrested, read his rights, taken to the station, signs a Miranda form, gives a statement, period. But Graddick had the police report that shows that Chris was arrested at 12:30. He has the Miranda form that shows it wasn't signed until after 9 p.m. And more importantly, he had the timestamps on Chris's statement that shows that short 12-page statement, the statement the jury just heard read to them, which from my experience takes about 10 to 15 minutes, depending on how fast you're reading, that show that that statement took over 2 hours to compile. What I think Graddick could have and should have done was question Donald hard about what was going on during those 2+ hours. Why did it take over 2 hours to get that statement out? But that's another discrepancy that Graddick didn't catch. And for all intents and purposes, Donald's testimony stood unchallenged in front of the jury. He arrested Chris. Chris signed the Miranda waiver, gave a statement implicating Shaky and Terrell voluntarily. Shaky came in and took a polygraph exam. Terrell came and went. Then Chris decided that he needed to come clean and tell the truth. And that's when he confessed. Case closed. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.